Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here today to talk with John Gillick and John Elliott, one benefits whiz, one financial whiz, and we're going to talk about the TSP. First, we'll talk about the basics of the TSP, you know, what's in a fund, what isn't in a fund, and then we're going to talk about strategies, and then we'll talk about rates of return. How about that? John Gillick being the financial planner, John, and John Elliott, and John is retired federal employee, a retired seminar presenter, knower of many and all things federal, benefit-wise, and Social Security. It's been a while. Good to see you, John.
Good to see you.
All righty. So let's start at the basics. What, you know, they have these letter things and they have these L things. Could we just talk about the basics? So some of the people are going to say, yes, I already know that. Others are going to say, well, I'm not so sure about that. So this should fit all.
We'll cover all the bases for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Bob, it's the simplest, most complicated plan I think there is in the country. And that's, I think it's made complicated because folks tend to overthink it. And when I'm out there teaching, I get a lot of questions back, but it breaks down that there's five choices. There's five choices, G, F, C, S, and I. And I like to make it real simple in class. The G and the F funds are your bond funds. They're going to give you a fixed income-like return, interest. The underlying investments are bonds. Then you have CS and I, which those are the stock funds. And the easy way to remember that I tell folks is CSI stands for Crime Scene Investigation, which is exactly what you like to call, you know, when your account value drops down. Because if you're using those funds periodically, we're going to see downturns in the economy, downturns in the market, and you're going to see those funds drop. And the intuition in that case is for folks to flee. And I call that flee to G, flee to safety. But the reality is if you have a long career and you're putting money in out of your paycheck, what in the financial world we call dollar cost averaging, which is a terminology I hate, because they should just simply say putting your money into the market on a regular interval. But if you're doing that, you want that volatility. You want the prices to drop. You want to buy more shares at a lower price. So those are the kind of things we can talk about today. You know, what are strategies as the economy changes, as the market goes through changes? In every time we teach, I'm sure like every other instructor out there, I always get the one or two folks that are extremely scared about something, and that something, you know, changes. I mean, recently now it's Russia. A couple years ago it was Greece, but then you don't hear about Greece anymore. And those things always come up, and it's that that fear that causes, I think, folks to think that somehow within this plan it's a good idea to jump back and forth and attempt to time the market. So those are the things that I think that we can really cover to help folks out, to give them some perspective on what they should be doing within this plan.
Could I ask you a question?
Sure.
When we started out, we talked about that the G fund and the F fund were bonds. But as Mike Causey has often said, the G fund has never had a bad day. So if it's subject to market risks, how can it never have a bad day, the G fund, but the F fund could? How does that work?
How does it work? Well, the G fund, and I'm reading from the description, government securities, and then in parentheses, specially issued to the TSP. And that's a great question. You know, how they can never go negative, I think is maybe a John Elliott question. But it's something.
Well, they don't. You can't ever lose money in the G fund. You potentially can in the F fund. But over the years, the F fund hasn't lost money very often.
Right.
So the F fund is pretty stable as well. But I've seen, I think, one or two years, maybe just one. Last time I looked over a 10-year period, I haven't looked recently. But the F fund lost money only one a year out of a decade, and it was a very slight drop. You didn't lose much. G fund, you can't lose money because it's all government securities, government bonds. As John said, specifically issued for the TSP. So yeah, it's a super safe fund, but if you you don't want to base a long-term investment strategy on the G fund because and ignoring the stock funds because you're likely over a period of time to end up with far less money. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Good, Bob.
The G fund is legislated in so it's not going to lose money, and it's going to pay a better than a decent rate of interest and can pay a very good rate of interest depending on the interest rates in the environment. However, the F fund, while bonds, they're both corporate and government. Somebody listening might say, well, how can a government bond ever lose money? And it's actually pretty easy. It might lose money value, let's call it value, in the short run because interest rates are going up. In other words, if somebody buys a bond at a fixed rate of X percent and interest rates go up, that bond might be a U.S. bond, but if it had to be cashed in, it wouldn't be worth as much as if somebody waited to maturity. And that's how it can, quote, lose money. It's a valuation fluctuation. And on the same side, the corporate bonds probably pay a better rate of interest, but there's more, quote, risk. I don't really like the term risk because it sounds like to be avoided. It's just know when to be there and when not. So if you figure interest rates are going up, you know, and I've been hearing this, I'm sure both of you guys as well, interest rates are going up and the bond's going to get killed. Well, it just hasn't. And maybe it's artificially down, but nonetheless, it's there. But that's how it can, right, quote, lose money. But it's really losing value. If you hold a bond to maturity, you're going to get the full amount. Does it make sense?
Makes sense.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, and you have another dynamic with the bonds is that as credit ratings change up and down,
mm-hmm.
A company's downgraded, and GMAC was a perfect prime example. And I'm not sure what the holdings would have been in the F fund of the GMAC smart notes, but they were something that I was holding in portfolios, and some of those notes dropped significantly in value, greater than 50% when we went through the mortgage banking crisis. Those bonds today have come back up in value to pretty much face value. That company went through the transition. The government took them over. Things like that happen. So it can not just – it's not only interest rate changes or interest rate increases. It can have a downward pressure on bond prices. The interest doesn't change that those bonds are receiving, but changing credit quality, whether a company's AAA, AA, A, triple B rated. And I believe back when I was selling the GMAC smart notes, they were A-plus rated by Standard & Poor's, and suddenly they were down in the C ratings. And that corrected itself, but in some cases they don't correct themselves. But the nice thing about a mutual fund is you're holding not just one bond, you're holding hundreds and hundreds or thousands of different bonds. So you may have one or two that fail. The bonds don't make it to maturity. They quit paying interest, but the majority of the portfolio will. So you can see the F fund go negative, but I'm looking at the period from 2000 to 2009. There wasn't a negative year in there, and we went through two horrible drops in the market within that decade.
Yeah, was the F fund during that 10-year period the highest earning fund?
Yes, it was.
Yeah,
6.39% was the 10-year compound versus the G fund, 4.62.
Yeah, that was my memory of it,
And incidentally, during that period of time, the C fund managed to lose 0.94% of your money almost on an annual basis. So when folks look at that data, it's kind of hard to make a valid judgment.
Yeah, the trouble is people panic.
Right.
And like in the approaching storm, or maybe after the storm had hit in 2007 and 2008, people were bailing out of the stock funds into this super safe G fund. And if they... then okay, but then you have to figure out when to get back in, and almost nobody can tell you when the right time to get back in is. Some people probably didn't and missed starting in 2009 the stock market started going up, and the last what are we in 5 years the stock market's gone gangbusters. So that's a mistake people make, is they panic and bail out, particularly if they're still employed and being able to put money in. As you said earlier, Yeah, the stock market may be going badly, but you're purchasing stock at cheaper prices. So when the market goes up, as it always seems to, then you've got more shares going up with it.
That's correct.
Okay. The, for those that are listening, say, what's GMAC? It's General Motors, GM Acceptance Corporation. It's their bond wing, if you will. So just in case somebody thinks it's a government bond, it's not.
And actually, during that period of time, GMAC was not having issues. It was GM, the car maker, having the issues. But obviously, with that close of a connection, it created some extra down pressure on the GMAC smart notes.
Okay. So we took a look at the G fund and the F fund and kind of drilled into what's in there and what might cause the F fund to have market fluctuations, both good and bad. But like John Elliott says, overall, it's been rather steady. Now, the C fund. C fund is, I remember it this way, you probably have a better way, common stocks.
Common
C
stocks.
Fund, common stocks.
Bob, I don't remember it that way because stock has such a negative connotation for folks out there. They hear the word stock and half the folks see opportunity and the other half cringe. It's the glass half full, glass half empty mentality that you run into with folks. I prefer company fund because you're within this fund, you're looking at the 500 largest companies and medium-sized companies, all U.S. companies on the New York Stock Exchange Big Board. So and I'm looking at the C Fund sheet here. This is from the TSP website. The top 10 holdings at the end of December of 2012, they haven't updated for 2013 yet. Apple, Exxon, GE, Chevron, IBM, Microsoft, Johnson & Johnson, AT&T, Google, and Procter & Gamble. As I would say to anyone in a class that I teach, if all 10 of those companies go out of business on the same day of the year, then clearly we've got...
all the funds are gone.
Yeah, we don't have to worry about too much at that point about from a retirement standpoint. Not to mention, you know, if those 10 companies gone, and those are the top 10, where are the other 490 at? Clearly not in any better condition. And even if you're working for the federal government at that time, there's only a certain amount of time you get paid before there's no more tax revenue to pay you. So this global catastrophe thinking that we run into in class once in a while, or just you know, consulting with clients, I mean, you really got to pull away from that. I mean, you've got to assume that the world's going to be around long after you've you know, retired, you know, even died, and that folks are still taking their kids to Disney, and on the way down there they go to McDonald's and they get a Happy Meal, and that the world continues on as a wonderful place.
Unhealthy, but. Continues
unhealthy, but you know, it's not
felt good going down. There's a very astute listener of the show, an emailer, and we corresponded a few times yesterday, and he mentioned once that there was a certain fund that he would like to see in the TSP's mix. Although I don't know that they'll ever do funds; they do indexes,
right?
But then I thought to myself, well, I bet the C fund has these same stocks in it that's in this particular fund, and darn if their top 10 holdings weren't already in the C fund. So, in other words, what I'm getting at, the C fund might encompass other funds but not be as directed, like this one we were talking about.
Absolutely.
Was just in one industry. Yeah. And it was, you know, substantial companies, but nonetheless, they were already in the C fund.
Well, and it's interesting. A lot of times I'll have the folks that you know, clearly are into the index funds. I like index funds in one case, and that's when the stock market or the index is going up.
Like last year.
They're very good in a rising market situation because they're inexpensive. There's no manager, no captain of the ship, and if you're putting money in into your paycheck, you want the ups and downs, and you want minimum expense as you're on the way up. But the problem becomes is, you know, if we go to the ship analogy, and you don't have a captain, here comes the typhoon, right? The hurricane, that ship's going to pilot right through the center of it. There's no one making any fundamental decisions on, you know, hey, should we be holding too much in technology right now? And that was exactly the case back in 2000, 2001, 2002. And during that period of time, the C fund dropped 9.14% in 2000. 2001, it dropped 11.94. And the year after that, 2002, 22.05. And if you look at any of the major mutual funds out there, And you can start with the Fidelities and the Vanguards and the American funds and the Franklin Templetons. And you compare their funds that track the S&P 500. They had unloaded. They weren't top-heavy with technology. The C fund at that point, I believe, was over 40% in technology because there's no one guiding the ship. So when it went down hard. But the beauty of the C fund in a plan like this is that at the bottom, at the end of 2002, you were buying your shares if you continued to invest in. The dividends from the C fund were also reinvesting for you. You were buying at 50 to 54 cents off.
Dollar cost averaging.
And if you're accumulating shares, that's exactly what you want to do. But flash forward to retirement, and I get this question all the time: what should I do in retirement? And I'm a clear: you should be fully diversified across many different investments. So if someone said, "What would you do in retirement?" I'd say I would roll to an IRA, and I would consider a much more broad based array of investments designed to hopefully at that point give you a rising income.
Okay. Now, John, you mentioned that there was nobody steering the ship. So that was not a comment to the thrift board. The C fund is designed, it's set in motion, and it goes.
That's correct.
The thrift folks don't manage what's inside of it. They say, okay, this is a good index, and this is what we're going to do. But as John said, you know, be careful about that. And if you're tracking it and you're clairvoyant, maybe you get out of it before. Mm-hmm. And if you're clairvoyant, you get back in. But not too many people are clairvoyant.
Yeah, timing the market is a difficult thing in any case. I like to say, if you look at the top, we all know who these folks are, the top two wealthiest folks in the world, generally Bill Gates and Warren Buffett trading positions. I mean, that's like, fair to say.
And Carlos Slim, the Mexican tele guy, he occasionally pops up.
Speaking of Warren Buffett, he was asked on a TV show, if you could give a person one piece of investment advice, what would it be? And he said, well, if just one, I would say find a stock index fund and hold it for 20 years, if not longer, I suppose. And so, I mean, that's what he's saying. So chances are he might be right since he has a tremendous track record. Maybe not lately, but...
Right. Okay. Well, but in Warren's case, too, yeah, he's a guy that's out there buying stocks. He's buying companies. He's actually a mutual fund manager. And his whole idea is that, he wants to beat the market. So I think you have to look at it from a long-term perspective. And what I encourage everyone to do out of the class, especially the folks, classes that are really into the investing side of it, is that you can go out to any of the major fund sites. Pick one, pick them all, and there's calculators out there that allow you to run various mutual funds and investments that you may be considering up against things like the S&P 500 index. And I think if you look at that over a 20, 30-year period, the numbers are strikingly different. And what happens is the indexes will do very well in a rising market situation. You'll get more return out of an index because it's going to float, and it's made up of the best performing stocks. But in the reverse condition where the market's going down, that's the concern I have, is that there's nothing to protect you. And the TSP is one thing and one thing only. It's probably the best wealth accumulation retirement plan in the country. You put your money in at a regular interval out of your paycheck, but it was not designed to be a income producing vehicle at the tail end. So when your money's not going in anymore, and now you're doing what we call reverse dollar cost averaging. You're pulling your money out of the investments at a regular interval. It just wasn't designed to produce what we would like to see in retirement, which is a rising income. So there's a lot in that statement, but I always fall back to what I say to folks in class, is that you really, really need to get some professional advice if this is not your field of expertise. You need someone to look at your bigger picture, your risk tolerance, your understanding of investments, and help guide you through that process.
All right, let's take a look at the S&I and then revisit that comment with the introduction of the L fund, because the L fund is, I think, a little bit zeroed in on retirement or not retirement. Anyway, so what's in the S fund? What does S stand for?
S, and again, I'll read the description so that I don't get it wrong from the TSP perspective. Stocks of small to medium-sized U.S. companies, and then in parentheses, not included in the C fund.
How many this index is like a basket of stock. How many stocks are, is it like 4,500?
To match the performance of the Dow Jones U.S. Completion TSM Index.
Okay.
So, it's about 40.
Yeah, I think it's 4,500. Yeah,
it was and may still be. I don't know.
Okay, so it's a lot of stocks, and it, you know, the S I sometimes remember it as small company, but you know, when you think of small company, is it the gas station down the street? Is it a Subway franchise? No, these are big companies.
Okay, I've got the answer. As of December 31st, 2012, the index was composed of 3,105 common stocks.
Okay.
So but there we go.
These are big companies,
though. It's less than it used to be.
Yeah. It's hard to get an answer out of me unless I've got it on paper.
Okay. So between the C and the S, they got the gorillas in the room all separated.
Well, you've got the U.S. covered.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's not national, international, but that's, I guess, why they have this thing called the iFund.
iFund.
Now, does the I stand for international?
Yes, I'll go for international on that one.
Okay.
But surprisingly,
you're going to read from the text, huh?
Well,
good.
As far as the number of companies contained in the iFund, 909 total, spread across Europe, Australia, the Far East. But surprisingly, there's one country missing from the list, and this has always been interesting for me, which is China. We got Hong Kong. We got a little piece down there, but China's actually missing from the iFund.
Hmm.
And I'm not sure it's interesting when that comes up. I've had folks that are very into the markets, and they go, how could that be possible? And I would say as a financial person, yeah, how could that be possible? But
it's not.
It's not in there. Right. So there's one little interesting factoid about the iFund, but you do need the iFund in there for balance. A lot of firms out there that I'm familiar with are – somewhere between 25% to 35% on a recommendation for portfolios for international. And a lot of what's going to happen in the future is going to be overseas, and it's due to this rapid rising middle-class population that we see around the world.
All righty, and remember the iFund is not a product of the Thrift Board. This is based on a model in the financial world, and they use it, but they don't control who's in it and who's not in it.
And I think that's probably where John can chime in. He's familiar, I'm sure, a little more than I am with the inner workings of the Thrift Board. But I get that comment once in a while where folks go, well, I thought the Thrift Board was managing all these funds.
No.
And John?
Well, no, they're not.
Right. I mean, it's...
know what else to say.
Your federal benefits specialist said no.
So they administer it, and that's a lot of work.
Well, but administer, meaning they've provided the investments choices, the five investment choices.
And these are all three stock funds are, as you said, index funds. So that implies no captain, right, as you said?
That's right.
So
to the individual funds themselves. Because the funds themselves are running, they're simply just modeling the index.
Yeah, and your returns or losses are based on the aggregate performance of each fund. It's not, you and apparently no one else is evaluating individual stocks in that particular fund. It's all, as 500 companies in the S&P go, as an aggregate, that's what causes your returns to go up or go down, as the case may be.
That's correct.
So I kind of look at this. It's something on a balance beam, and you put your weights on there, and then hope you come out better. But let's take a look at the...
I have just one point to make about... I was in a seminar. I mean, I was doing it, but we brought in a financial planner. This was years ago. This was right after the stock market started to go up in 2002, March or 2003. Yeah, it was March. But anyway, and I was stupidly 100% in the C fund as I'd been for years. And that was good in the 90s, but it was terrible, as you pointed out, in those 3 years in the early part of the century. But one member of the class, she actually used the financial planner advisor, and he had advised her to put money in the S fund as well. I don't know about the I fund, but she made up her losses far more. I talked to her far more quickly than I did, because the S fund, I guess, was really shooting up fast. So the point is, if you just, you got to diversify among the three stock funds as well, and maybe throw in a certain percentage in the bond funds.
That's correct. And as far as that, I mean, as recommendations, when folks, and it does not matter who I'm speaking with, you have to use all five funds. I mean, it would be very hard for me to see someone make a case to say, you know, I'm just going to put my money in the C fund. Unless they had a broadly diversified stock portfolio outside of the TSP, and the TSP was just one small component of a much bigger financial net worth. For most folks in federal service, they're going to take their money and they're going to use G, F, C, S, and I together, and it's a perfect segue to the L funds. And when I teach folks, I used to kind of hesitate to say this is what I would recommend, but my broad recommendation would be that anyone in federal service could benefit from the L funds. If I was in federal service, I would use the L funds because, quite frankly, I do this for a living, and I don't like to figure it out. I want something that's going to automatically manipulate the selections for me. Now, when I say that, when you look at the L funds, there's the L income, which is
current. Let's take a look at the L funds.
Because L-2020, yeah. L-2030, 40, 50. And I know what happened. I think John and I spoke about this a couple of years back on a show. The trustees looked at the plan and they realized that folks were sitting on the sidelines, and I call it on the sidelines in the G fund. At the end of 2012, there's $158.5 billion in the G fund. And the amount of money in the C fund at that time, which in my opinion should be the flagship fund in the family, where you're going for growth, that's the purpose of this plan, $88.9 billion, about half. And what's shocking is when I teach, and I'll be teaching at a facility here this week that I know there's going to be a lot of younger folks, and what I'll find is that a lot of those folks that have been in service for two or three or 4 years, just fresh out of college, are sitting there in the G fund, because that's the default fund when you get into the plan. And clearly, those are the folks that would benefit from being in the stock-based funds. And it's just a lack of, I want to say, initial education from when they get in, because no one's really held their hand to say, hey, this is what you should do with that plan. I always encourage our older service folks to get together with their younger folks to say, hey, you know, kind of grab their hand and say, this is what you should do, or hey, if I had it to do over, maybe this is the direction I would take. Obviously, getting into one of our classes is a great way to go.
Yeah, the younger folks should be in the 2050 fund, because it's stock heavy. It's about, 85-90% in the three stock funds and only about 10-15% in the two bond funds?
12% in the two bond funds.
Okay, so 88% in the stock funds, split up among all three stock funds. So as the L funds, of course, use all five funds. As you get older, I mean, you don't have to move, you don't want to have to move from the 2050 fund. Over, I think it's every quarter, little bit moves into the more conservative bond funds. Over a long period of time, you end up with more bonds than stocks when you're about ready to retire. Now, my point or question is that seems to me the L funds, as you're nearing retirement, tends to be a little too conservative for my taste.
Oh, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I think there's a reason for that.
Go ahead.
Well, I think the reason is that if I'm a trustee, and I'm just going to surmise here, if I'm a trustee and I realize that someone's in the L funds, they really don't want to be involved with the investment decisions. there's two different types of folks. The folks that don't want to be involved with the investment process or decisions, and then there's folks that are very knowledgeable and they choose not to do it. They choose to have an automatic process. And then there's folks out there that are trying to jockey the funds back and forth by themselves. And I just want to read the first paragraph of the L Fund fact sheet, and I would encourage anyone in federal service to do this, because I think folks get caught up in the pictures with the pie charts. But the first paragraph tells me, as a financial professional, everything that I need to know about the L Fund to make my recommendation. And it starts out, the L Fund is diversified participant accounts among the GFCS&I, so there's your five funds, using professionally determined investment mixes, and then in parentheses they have allocations that are tailored to different time horizons. And this is important. The time horizon is when you expect to need the money. And it's in parentheses over on the sidebar, time horizons, when you expect to need the money. These are not retirement target date funds. If you're not going to spend the money, and we see this a lot with folks that are retiring from federal service, if they have a low debt load, they've got the pension, potentially Social Security if they're FERS, they may not need to spend the money directly into retirement. They might delay that, which means that you would want to account for that. If it's going to be five additional years into retirement before you spend your TSP, then you would want to be in one of these funds that's 5 years further from your retirement date. It goes on to say the L funds are rebalanced to their target allocations each business day. I know of no other plan. My plan, my 401k private plan, rebalances every 3 months. I wish I could have a daily rebalance. So what I say to folks in classes, this is a program that every day the market's dramatically up or down and you're enjoying your life, which is what you should be doing, not worrying about this stuff. There's a computer program and they're rebalancing you back to the original percentages. So you're taking from the stocks if they've gone up that day significantly and you're buying some bonds. And the reverse of the stocks have dropped, they're taking from your bonds, which have swelled up a little bit because of the drop in the market, and they've moved it in the other direction. That's awesome. It's the only plan I'm aware of that does daily rebalance. And then they even made it nicer, which John has already said. The final sentence of the paragraph, the investment mix of each fund adjusts quarterly to more conservative investments as the fund's time horizon shortens.
Yeah, you can get on TSP.gov, yeah, and you can see how that works, and it'll actually tell you what little tiny fraction of a percent it moved that quarter. So if you want to track
that's awesome.
Yeah, it is good. I should add, we should add that, let's say you're getting too far into bonds to suit yourself. I mean, if you're comfortable with that, that's, I guess, maybe what you should do. But you can then move to a higher L fund. You know, you're not locked into 2050 or 2020. My time horizon could, they recommend maybe I should be in the 2020 fund. But for until the 2050 fund came, and either 2040 was the top fund. I was in the 2040 fund, but now I'm about 50 stocks. I should add, I'm retired, and I'm coming up in 3-4 years where I'm going to have to start taking minimum distributions. But I'm about 50%. I'm using all five funds, but I'm about 50-50 stocks and bonds. Mm-hmm. At my age.
And we're talking with John Gillick, certified financial planner, and John Elliott, been there, done it, investor in the thrift and the like. And John Gillick and I are saying, boy, I wish I had one of these things.
I sure do, Bob.
Okay. So, and how does one get in touch with you?
They can reach me at 301-704-0544. 301-704-0544, or by email is Trader John J, letter J at gmail.com, which has nothing to do with trading stocks. It had everything to do with being one of the first folks on eBay. So okay. Maybe I should change that one day. Might give the wrong impression.
Well, whatever. All righty. So again, we're 202-465-3080. We've laid, I'd say, a very solid understanding of how these different funds work, what makes them good, what makes them maybe not so good at times. Now, strategies. If we were to start off, maybe let's start off with the beginning career, folks. Not the first week on the job, but say first 5 years into the job. What if I came to you when I was one of those folks, which I sure am not, what would you tell me to do? And, you know, I don't really know the market. I think I understand the differences between the funds, but I don't know what to do.
It's a great question. What I would recommend they do is look at the L funds. I mean, I'd coach them through the L funds. We'd actually, you know, read through that material together. I'd coach them that, you know, their interference with the investments, you know, throughout their career would probably cause, you know, much more harm than good. And I'd most likely have them, as John has already said, in the L2050. That's the furthest out you can get. And, you know, over the years, I believe they're going to see very good results. And that fund will it's kind of like I call it, you know, like a butterfly, you know, like the caterpillar to the butterfly. As you get closer to the, you know, the retirement point, which is your butterfly, it's going to slowly metamorphosize itself into the L income fund. You really, if you take that approach as a new federal, you know, worker, you can pretty much, you know, put this thing on autopilot. You are, in this case, having a captain to your ship, meaning now you have something which, in the form of a program, manipulating the GFCSNI for you as you progress through your career. And as John said, if you find yourself mid-career and that you're not growth-oriented enough, then you could always go out to, you know, at that time in the future, sometime you'll have the L2060 and then the L2070, and you can always continue to push yourself out further if you want to have more in stock versus bonds.
Yeah, if your long-term plan is to not take any money out till you're 70 and a half, and then you only have to take, and Bob can speak to this better than I can, you only have to take, and John, I'm sure, you only have to take minimal distributions, well, then you can probably afford to be a little more aggressive in stocks, I would think.
Mm-hmm. And I think more growth-oriented. I try to avoid saying aggressive, because as soon as folks hear that, they think that, you know, they're doing something that's, you know, really, really crazy.
Yeah, and I don't want to say risky.
This is an investment bungee jumping here.
Okay, so we're back to the newbie, if you will, the young newbie. This isn't newbie. Somebody private industry coming into the feds. This is somebody in their 20s, maybe early 30s. Then the question would be, okay, you've laid out what makes things more to my liking as far as investments go, but the scratching the head here is, do I do the Roth TSP or do I do the traditional TSP? The investment's going to be the same, but one is going to give you tax benefit now, and the other one is going to give you a huge tax benefit later. Maybe I should be asking myself this question, but
I know that's a CPA question, Bob. But and I struggle with that when I teach, and my answer is always, everybody needs some. Everybody needs some Roth, and if you're starting out early career, the beauty of the Roth is that the money goes in. You're going to pay your taxes now. You're in a lower tax bracket. Down the road, that money becomes completely tax free at 59 and a half.
And it's got all those years to grow.
Years and years to grow and compound. And, you know, the Roth is a phenomenal opportunity. But later in life, if we're talking late career, a lot of folks, I still would say they would want to put some money in the Roth. But if they go overboard, they're going to cause themselves some pretty severe tax consequences.
So let's move on up the line. Greg Long, the director of the Thrift, comes on a couple times a year, and he had this great analogy. He called it the barbell effect. So picture somebody lifting weights, and you guys could do this better than me, but, you know, there's enough weight on either end to bend the bar a little bit. So beginning career folks, they're going to be saying, well, I've got this compounding opportunity for life. The Roth looks probably much better for that individual than if we start moving up the line. So let's say now we're in the center and we're mid-career, and we're saying Roth or traditional TSP. We've got to scratch our head a little bit. Now, from a tax perspective, mm-hmm. Taxes should never come before economics, ever. Hard to believe that I said that, but it shouldn't. So economics would say, well, if I put the money in, I'm still going to continue the growth, but I might need the tax benefit more now because potentially there's a family or there's a spouse that there wasn't before, and I would like to put the money away, but taxes mean a lot to me. But again, finances should come number one, taxes number two. And then on the other side, mid-career, you were about to say something.
No, mid-career, I'm going to pick an L fund in the middle.
Okay.
2030, 2040. I don't like to complicate it, and it's interesting. I'll teach class, and I get the folks that are investment savvy that come up, and they say, hey, I noticed that the L funds are really heavy on the G, but, I know that, yes, the F could go negative potentially, but, for the majority of the time, the F beats the G, and it's a bond fund. Couldn't I model what they're doing in the L funds on my own? And the answer is yes, but if you start manipulating the individual funds again, you miss out on that daily rebalancing and the quarterly more conservative. And as I like to say, there's not one single person, and if you're out there, please call in the federal service, that gets on the computer every night and makes minute adjustments to their account based on what the market did that day. And you're not going to beat the technology of a program that can do that for you. So missing out on that opportunity in the L funds, it doesn't matter to me whether you're just starting out or your late career. I think the L funds are a phenomenal opportunity.
Okay.
Because they have that manipulation built in.
Let's push it on out now then to the late career pre-retirement. Again, following this kind of barbell effect, we're not nearing retirement, but it's closer to our visual than what it was at the early part. And again, I'm talking about Roth versus traditional.
Gotcha.
Here, people ask, well, what's it mean? And I said, well, look at it this way. And again, this is another quote from Greg. He said, pay me now or pay me later. So with regards to the traditional TSP, you get the tax deduction. So it's, I'm putting my money in, and Uncle Sam said, okay, you can pay me later when you take it out. The Roth TSP, or the Roth IRA for that matter, is the reverse. Pay me now. So in other words, you're putting the money in, so you're reducing your bring home, but you have to write a check at the end of the year. And later on in the career, maybe I do some, but that's got a real multiplier effect. Somebody in a combined federal and state tax bracket of 33%, and they want to put 22.5 into the thrift, and to the Roth thrift, they have to put the 22.5 in, plus they have to send Uncle a third of that, $7,500. I don't know. That's full boat.
Right,
say, somebody ought to have some, but if you go full tilt, that's what it's going to cost you.
Well, I think you really get to the point of, and Bob's the perfect person to be in this conversation, maybe even an estate planning attorney, but now you get into the question of, are we talking about generational planning? Are you late career? You're willing to pay the tax. You've got future potential grandkids that haven't materialized yet, but you're confident that that's going to happen at some point. That Roth can be passed on to future generations and maintain its tax-deferred growth and tax-free nature. There's a couple books on that out there, but I've got folks looking at it from, hey, we have no bills, John. We've got, all this money pre-tax in the TSP, which all of it's going to have to be taxed one day, rather than build that up, why don't we go ahead and pay some tax now? Yes, the taxes are going to be high, but quite frankly, we can pay the tax and have it in the Roth, or we're going to be taking it in our paycheck and it's going to be sitting at the credit union. Can't we somehow utilize this Roth opportunity for future generations of, our kids for, say, education? And the answer is yes. That Roth could be, they could maximize contributions, or say take of the 22.5 or 23,000, they could put in 10,000 into the Roth, pay the taxes on the 10,000, or pay the taxes above and beyond the 10,000. They do that for 5 years prior to retirement. They've got a nice $50,000 chunk of money in the Roth that's not 50 anymore if we've got growth in the markets. And they can invest that knowing that they intend to pass it on to their children, their grandchildren, who they have the option through what's called a stretch IRA, a stretch Roth IRA, to take distributions over their lifetimes. And if done properly, that could grow to a very
huge number.
Very huge number. And I've modeled that out for some folks that are very long-range thinkers, and they go, wait a minute, so if that 50 every 8 to 10 years doubles, so the 50 doubles to 100 to 200 to 400 to 800 to 1.6 million, I could be leaving future generations of, you know, to my great-great-grandkids, you know, tax-free income stream that could pay for education, weddings, and yeah, that's exactly how it works. Charitable organizations, you know, member of one of the Kennedy Center societies down there, and same thing. I mean, you could leave a heck of a legacy behind. You know, I mean, such a legacy they might even put a plaque on the wall for you. So there's strategies, and that's why you know, the help of you really at that point need to talk to your team, your CPA, your financial planner, your estate planning attorney, and make sure that you have a plan that you know, will materialize what you want it to down the road, because the tax code's complicated. Is it getting any less complicated?
I've never seen it worse.
Right.
And I didn't think I could say that.
Right.
I thought it was going to get easy, and I'm going to geese here, in 1986 when the Reagan, this is not a political statement, they were called the Reagan tax cuts, and they took out all the gunky things in the law and replaced it with lower rates. And I said, oh my goodness, they're going to have a flat tax. I'm not going to have a job. The tax law is many, many, many more times complicated than it was prior to the Reagan tax cuts. And again, this is not a political statement. This happened all through after 86, whatever side of the aisle somebody's on, it happened. And they just kept putting these ornaments on the tree, and now the tree's getting a little heavy.
It was interesting. I love you know, bringing it back to, you know, where we were. Folks really worry about the economy and technology, and I stopped by a place yesterday, and you know, while I was doing what I had to do, the kids were able to play a free machine with Pac-Man and Donkey Kong, and I mean, that takes you a long, long ways back in the video game world. And now, I mean, they're pretty much 3D graphics, high speed, and all that relates to computing power. And I always joked every time they came out with a new processor for computers, because I had one of the very first TI-99-4As running BASIC. But every time they come out with a new processor, they develop software to take advantage of it, and the computers have never really seemed to run faster. I mean, now we're seeing some faster speeds, but I think it relates back to the tax code. You can expect it to get worse before it gets better, because they've got the computing power to keep track of all the little details. So, yeah, I think they're going to find more and more unique ways to tax us, and it doesn't matter who's in the office. I just think that's the trend that you're going to see is, you know, if they want to tax you on a bottle cap, right? Every bottle you open, you pay a tax on the cap. One day they'll have a chip in the cap, and they'll know that it's your hand on the bottle. It's going to get more complicated before it gets less complicated. So I think you have to prepare for that. And from a taxation standpoint, we're still at the lowest personal tax rate since 1950. And, you know, I say that in class, taxes are going to go up on everyone. And the taxes are not going to discriminate on this next upsweep. And I think you have to be prepared for that. And the best way to do that is, again, have a team, have a financial planner, have a CPA, have an attorney, have folks that are near enough to each other that you can pull them together. But then again, near enough now is a conference call.
Yes, and shows like this.
Absolutely.
And seminars like we all present and did present. All righty, so we got all the letters down. We got some, not some, we talked a lot about strategy at the different stages of one's career. And I like what you said about the Roth. I find in class, we talk about it, but I don't drill maybe down like you do. And the people come up at the break and I go, I take it this Roth is not for you. Not because they don't want to do it. It's because they want to do it, but it's not money that they're ever going to touch. They want to put some money away, like you say, for future generations. And as John mentioned, that future generation, when the unfortunate thing happens that the owner passes, they don't have to take it out all at once. They can spread it out over their lifetime, which is affectionately called a stretch IRA. It's got a little bit more to it than that, but it's not hard. And then with regards to the thrift, when leaving the money to the thrift and the traditional, and there's a spousal issue, be careful there. If you leave it to the spouse and then the spouse passes, it's not pretty what happens to it. But that's a whole other discussion.
It's a whole different
but
day.
But it's a warning shot. All righty, we got a few more minutes before Andrew cuts us off. Right, Andrew? Andrew's the engineer of the show and keeps us on time and in line. So final thoughts, comments, schemes, excuse me, planning opportunities.
My final thought is seek out a professional, seek out a professional team. It's a lot of times I'll see folks come in that have a very complicated tax situation. They're still using a tax prep service, a tax prep in a box. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but you do have to realize in a certain point in your life that you need to seek out that one-on-one personalized advice. Same thing from an attorney standpoint. Folks say, geez, would you get your legal documents drawn up by an online service, a program in a box? And I say, I used a real live attorney.
John, you've been there, done it. We got less than a minute.
Yeah, I have. And I would say, first of all, visit tsp.gov and visit the calculator. That is an education of itself, just plugging in some scenarios and numbers. That is eye-opening. In addition, look at the FERS calculator at opm.gov, or CSRS if you're CSRS still. But and then there's a Social Security calculator for your FERS people at ssa.gov. But that TSP calculator is a real eye-opener.
Yep.
By all means, as soon as we get off the air.
Okay, we're going to get shut off the air. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week, and enjoy the week until next Monday, and then we'll be back on. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.